Some of these at times eclipse the sun, and are taken for sunspots, although, perhaps, not a million miles from the Earth. One, to a person unfamiliar with the inner workings of modern science, it may seem that modern man has his environment nicely under control and totally figured out. Nothing could be farther from the truth. The leaders of science who are searching the frontiers of modern theory argue among themselves, with their followers dissenting in droves behind them. As soon as a theory begins to receive wide acceptance as being a valid representation of physical laws, someone finds a discrepancy, and the theory has to be either modified or abandoned entirely. Perhaps the most well-known example of this is Newton's F equals ma. This attained the status of a physical law before being found to be an error. It is not that this equation has not proven extremely useful. We have used it to design everything from a moon rocket to the television picture tube. But its accuracy fails when applied to atomic particle accelerators like the cyclotron. To make accurate predictions of particle trajectories, it is necessary to make the relativistic correction formulated by Einstein. It is interesting to note that the reason for this correction is based on the fact that the speed of light is totally independent of the speed of its source. If Newton had penetrated more deeply into the laws of motion, he might have made this relativistic correction himself, and then stated that the velocity correction would always be of no consequence, since the velocity of light was so much greater than any speed attainable by man. This was very true in Newton's day, but is definitely not the case now. We still tend to think of the velocity of light as a fantastic and unattainable speed, but with the advent of space flight, a new order of velocities has arrived. We have to change our thinking from our normal terrestrial concepts of velocities. 40, Chapter 3, Reality, etc. Instead of thinking of the speed of light in terms of miles per second, think of it in terms of Earth diameters per second. The almost unimaginable 186,000 miles per second becomes an entirely thinkable 23 Earth diameters per second. Or we could think of the speed of light in terms of our solar system's diameter and say that light would speed at about 2 diameters per day. Einstein's assertion that everything is relative is so apparent that it has become a cliché of our culture. Let us continue being relativistic in considering the size of natural phenomena by considering the size of our galaxy. If you look up at the sky on a clear night, nearly all of the visible stars are in our own galaxy. Each of these stars is a sun like our own. A calculation of the ratio of the number of suns in our galaxy to the number of people on planet Earth discovers that there are 62 suns for each living person on Earth today. Earth's population is close to 4 billion, and there are 250 billion stars in the Milky Way. It takes light over 4 years to get from Earth to even the nearest of these stars. To reach the most distant star in our own galaxy would take light 100,000 years. These calculations are made using the assumption that light has a speed. This may be an erroneous assumption in the light of modern theory, but its apparent speed is a useful measuring tool, so we use it anyway. So we have a creation in which we find ourselves, which is so big that at a speed of 23 Earth diameters a second we must travel 100,000 years to cross our immediate backyard. That is a big backyard, and it would seem ample for even the most ambitious of celestial architects, but in truth this entire system of 250 billion stars is just one grain of sand on a very big beach. There are uncounted trillions of galaxies like ours, each with its own 250 billion stars, spread throughout what seems to be infinite space. When you think of the mind-boggling expanse of our creation, and the infantile state of our knowledge in relation to it, you begin to see the necessity for considering the strong probability that our present scientific approach to investigating these expanses is as primitive as the dugout canoe is in relation to the whole state of the art of earthbound transport. The most perplexing problem of science has always been finding a satisfactory explanation of what is called action at a distance. In other words, everyone knows that if you drop something it will fall, but no one knows precisely why. Many people know that electric charges push or pull on each other even if separated in a vacuum, but again no one knows why. 41, Chapter 3, Reality, etc. Although the phenomena are quite different, the equations which describe the force of interaction are quite similar. For gravitation, F equals gmm/r2; for electrostatic interaction, F equals kqq/r2. The attractive force between our planet and our Sun is described by the gravitational equation. The attractive force between orbiting electrons and the atomic nucleus is described by the electrostatic interaction equation. Now, each of these equations was determined experimentally. They are not apparently related in any way, and yet they both describe a situation in which attractive force falls off with the square of the distance or separation. A mathematical representation of an action at a distance effect is called a field, such as a gravitational or electric field. It was Albert Einstein's foremost hope to find a single relation which would express the effect of both electric and gravitational phenomena, in fact, a theory which would unify the whole of physics, a unified field theory. Einstein believed that this was a creation of total order and that all physical phenomena were evolved from a single source. Over the years, Einstein and other mathematical physicists published many unified field theories, none of them successful. A famous one, put forth by Kaluza, recast the mathematics of relativity in a space of five dimensions instead of the customary four. Kaluza hoped that unification of gravitation and electromagnetism would follow by a suitable interpretation of the fifth dimension. Einstein took up Kaluza's work, but once more no new physical understanding appeared. The most celebrated unified field theory, called the generalized theory of gravitation, was published by Einstein in 1945, and independently by Schrödinger at about the same time. By then Schrödinger was disillusioned by quantum mechanics, which he himself had helped to create. For some years both these eminent men believed that the new theory would solve the problems which they thought still beset fundamental physics. The mathematics of the theory is very complicated, and it is necessary to use approximate methods. With these it was shown that the theory failed to satisfy the basic requirement that its field equations must determine the motion of electric charges present. This was enough to convince Schrödinger that the theory was useless. Einstein was not prepared to accept the approximate results. He maintained that the 42, chapter 3, reality, etc. theory could be judged only if certain exact solutions of the generalized field equations were found. These exact solutions, he believed, would represent matter by pure field. This was the position he took up until his death. To this unified field theory, describing matter as pure field, has been accomplished now. It seems that the entire situation was analogous to the solution of a ponderously complex Chinese puzzle. If you can find the right key turns among so many wrong ones, the puzzle easily falls apart. Dewey B. Larson found the solution to this problem, and the puzzle not only fell apart, but revealed an elegantly adequate unified field theory rich in practical results. And, like a good Chinese puzzle, the solution was not complex, just unexpected. Instead of assuming five dimensions, Larson assumed six, and properly labeled them as the three dimensions of space and the three dimensions of time. He assumed that there is a three-dimensional coordinate time analogous to our observed three-dimensional space. The result of this approach is that one can now calculate from the basic postulate of Larson's theory any physical value within our physical universe, from subatomic to stellar. This I.X. sought after unified field theory is different because we are not accustomed to thinking of time as being dimensionally analogous to space. We have thought of time as an adimensional, as a stream moving in one direction. Yet once you get the hang of it, coordinate time is mathematically a more comfortable concept with which to deal. Professor Frank Meyer, of the Department of Physics at the University of Wisconsin, presently distributes a quarterly newsletter 3 to scientists interested in Larson's new theory, which explores perplexing questions in physical theory using Larson's approach. I was interested in testing Larson's theory and made extensive calculations using his postulate. I became convinced that his theory is indeed a workable unified field theory. If you are personally interested in checking this theory for yourself, I recommend obtaining his work and checking it as I did. For I had been pondering several interesting statements communicated through contactees by the alleged UFO source prior to discovering Larson's work in the early 60s. Although the people who had received these communications knew nothing of the problems of modern physics, they were getting information which apparently was quite central to physical theory. First, they suggested that the problem with our science was that it did not recognize enough dimensions. Second, they stated that light does not move, light is. Larson's theory posits six dimensions instead of the customary four, and finds the pure field, which Einstein believed would represent matter, 2, 43, chapter 3, reality, etc. move outward from all points in space at unit velocity, or the velocity of light. Photons are created due to a vibratory displacement in space-time, the fabric of the field. Furthermore, the contactees were saying that consciousness creates vibration, this vibration being light. The vibratory displacements of space-time in Larson's theory are the first physical manifestation, which is the photon or light. According to the UFO contacts, the UFOs lower their vibrations in order to enter our skies. The entire physical universe postulated by Larson is dependent on the rate of vibration and quantized rotations of the pure field of space-time. The contactees were suggesting that time is not what we think it is. Larson suggests the same thing. The UFOs were said to move in time as we move in space. This would be entirely normal in Larson's time-space portion of the universe. Lastly, and perhaps most importantly, the contactees were receiving the message that the creation is simple, all one thing. Larson's theory is a mathematical statement of this unity. The New Science Advocates is a group of scientists and philosophers currently promoting Larson's theory. In a recent news release, they had this to say about Larson's reciprocal system of theory: no previous theory comes anywhere near being a general theory in the true sense of the term. None of them is applicable to more than a relatively small part of physical science, and none is derived entirely from premises of a general nature. Everyone finds it necessary to make many assumptions specifically applicable to its restricted field of coverage. A theory of atomic structure makes assumptions about matter and about its basic forms. A theory of electrical phenomena makes assumptions about electricity and electric charges. A theory of quasars makes assumptions about quasars and about the radiation through which these objects make themselves known, and so on. Furthermore, all of these theories make use of a host of additional assumptions of a more general character that are embodied in the basic laws and principles of physics. But now we have a theory that makes no assumptions at all, other than those contained in the fundamental postulates as to the properties of space and time which define the theory. All conclusions, including those with respect to the basic physical laws and principles, are derived solely by deduction from those postulates, without invoking the aid of any supplementary or subsidiary assumptions, and without introducing anything from experience. 44, Chapter 3, Reality, etc. In our opinion, this totally unprecedented accomplishment is sufficient in itself to justify the most serious and painstaking study of the new theoretical structure. 5. An interesting extension of Larson's work is a conjecture which I have entertained that a more informed society might index events spatially rather than temporally. When is talks with Puharich about time, it would seem that they do this, for they say that a certain event was planned hundreds of light years ago. The metal-bending children when Uri Geller performs on TV, mentally bending metal and fixing clocks, there are often many kids who try to duplicate Uri's tricks. Sometimes the kids succeed. The number of children that can cause bends and breaks in metals and other materials just by wanting the break or bend to occur, is increasing daily. John Taylor, professor of mathematics at King's College, reports in his excellent book, Superminds, on the extensive tests run in England on several of these gifted children. What physicists have never before considered worth investigating is now increasing at a very rapid rate. Action at a distance, apparently as a result of some type of mental activity, seems repeatedly the observed effect. If the Gellerizing children continued to increase in numbers and ability, The 1980s will see such fantasies of TV as My Favorite Martian, I Dream of Jeannie, and Bewitched becoming a part of reality. So far, most of the ability shown by these children is in the area of bending and breaking materials. But there is some indication that they, like Geller and Matthew Manning, will develop other abilities as well. With controlled, repeatable experiments like those conducted by Taylor and by the Stanford Research Institute in the United States, we begin to have good, solid data available for study. Gradually, we are moving into a position from which we can begin to create a science of magic, for that which has been called magic through the ages is now being performed at an ever-increasing rate, primarily by children. In the future, we may even find this magic added to the curriculum of the sciences at universities. In point of fact, the present disciplines of chemistry, physics, etc., are still basically magic to us, since we are still in the position of having no ultimate explanation of causality. 45, Chapter 3, Reality, etc., Age Regression Hypnosis. During the past 20 years, I have done several hundred age regressions, working with subjects from various walks of life. With very few exceptions, I have discovered that the reasonably good hypnotic subject can be helped to remember experiences which occurred before his or her birth date into this present life. The large majority of these people remember lives which occurred prior to this life, but identifiable as being in the recent historical past. I have had people who are in this life quite ignorant of a certain foreign language, who under hypnosis, while re-experiencing moments of a previous life, are able to speak that foreign tongue. While there is no way to prove a theory of reincarnation, it is interesting to note that many researchers besides myself have reported many thousands of instances of these hypnotic regressions to previous lives. As one examines the mass of data which these regressions provide, one cannot help but note that the theory of reincarnation is a more substantively satisfactory explanation than some alternate theories, which attempt to be conservative and scientifically safe. Such latter explanations of the data of a good age regression case take each confirmed fact gained in a hypnotic session and say, the subject could conceivably have known this another way. The subject could be using telepathy. The subject could be clairvoyant. The explanations offered in this way strike me rather as an instance of going around Robin Hood's barn, when there is a broad and well-trodden path right through the forest. I say well-trodden, because three-quarters of the world's population ascribe to religions which include reincarnation within their structure of religious beliefs. Mediumship. The medium, a person who is able to act as a link with discarnate entities, is probably the most controversial of the common psychic types. I consider a good working knowledge of mediumship and its pitfalls essential to the study of alleged telepathic UFO contactees. As I have stated, there seem to be many planes or densities of existence, therefore it is not always possible to be sure of the source of a telepathic contact. A person visiting a medium for the purpose of communication with discarnate Uncle Herman may actually contact a residual portion of Uncle Herman's consciousness, another entity claiming to be Uncle Herman, or in many cases the subconscious of the medium. I am certain that many mediums and UFO contactees never, 46, Chapter 3, Reality, etc. intend fraud, and do not themselves realize the fraudulent nature of what they telepathically receive. The dedicated researcher will attempt to achieve an attitude of unbiased discrimination, listening to everything with suspended disbelief, yet reserving final judgment until his data is ponderous in quantity and correlations are extensive. Magic, real magic, not prestidigitation. W.E. Butler defines magic as the art of effecting changes in consciousness at will. 6. Generally, events are thought of as magical if they defy all rational or scientific attempts to explain them. As a consequence, as our scientific philosophy has expanded, our inclination to view natural events as magical has shrunk. We no longer consider thunderstorms to be of magical significance, because we know the physical mechanics which create the thunderstorm. That is, we think we do. What we have really done with thunderstorms is to find our way back to the more basic puzzle of electrostatics. Born into this world, We wake up in our crib and very slowly become aware of our surroundings. As long as these conditions of existence remain the same, we are satisfied to call our environment normal, reserving the label of paranormal for that which is contrary to the great body of our experience. That is, as long as we drop a stone and it continues to fall rather than float in air, we will accept that as the natural event and see a floating in air object that looks as though it should fall as supernatural. It is a difficult thing to do, but try to imagine for a minute a state of total lack of experience with this world. Try to look at it as if for the first time. Without labeling them, look at the people, the animals, the birds and insects, at foliage and sky. Feel the wonder creeping in. Now, in your mind, back off from the surface of the planet Earth and see it as a totality, a ball in space with a thin cloak of swirling air around it. You and the billions of others who live on Earth stand on its surface, the soles of your feet pointing inward, towards the center of the ball, your heads pointing outward, towards space. As you hold this in your mind, perhaps magic seems not so limited on our normal world. I believe that in truth, we have only a tiny sliver of understanding of reality, if indeed we have any at all. When a child stares at a spoon and it curls up, or breaks, we somehow find this more, 47, chapter 3, reality, etc. amazing than the magic of our daily experience. Perhaps these magical new events are clues to the real nature of man. The mechanisms of real magic motion in our physical world is usually the result of a potential energy such as gravitational, chemical, or electrical. The magician also works with potential energies, within consciousness, in order to create motion or displacement in mind. The magician works with potentials in consciousness similar to the physical activity of storing electrical charges in a battery. Just as a battery has a positive and a negative pole, so does consciousness. Many call this positive-negative polarity good and evil. There is ample evidence that it is possible to create a large potential through the manipulation of consciousness, whether it is done by intentional magical manipulation or by political rhetoric or religious exhortation. I would suggest that consciousness is more fundamental than physical matter. I find it hard to see even the possibility of physical matter creating consciousness. The magician, then, is working with the more fundamental of energy fields, to attain a more fundamental objective. The objective of the magician is to obtain predictive and manipulative control of consciousness. The white magician clearly defines for himself the limits of this manipulation of consciousness. His objective is the development of his own consciousness. The black magician is less careful about what consciousness he wishes to be able to manipulate, and thus becomes interested in the evil aspects of control over others' consciousness. The white magician wants to develop his consciousness, for he knows that it is the only thing he will be able to carry with him through the physical death. His attitude towards this physical life is that its one purpose is to provide him with the catalytic effects of physical experience for use in the development of his thinking. He sees himself as a micro-consciousness dwelling within macro-consciousness, and attempts to consciously unite himself with all that there is, so that the microcosm is one with the macrocosm. To put it another way, he is attempting to achieve realization of union with his Creator. The key to this attempt is control of consciousness. The more closely the magician approaches this goal of realized oneness with the creation, the more able he is to do seemingly magical things. He is tuning his mind to that of the Creator, and thereby displaying some of the abilities of creation. 48, Chapter 3, Reality, etc. The black magician has the reciprocal orientation in that he is attempting to achieve separation in mind rather than unification. He glorifies his own individuality and gains power by separating himself from all of creation and then declaring himself its master. Both white and black magical attitudes and practices are able to build high potentials in the field of consciousness, quite analogous to the creating of potential difference in electrical fields with positive and negative charges. Once a sufficient charge of consciousness has been stored, it may be used to create motion or change in consciousness, which in turn affects the physical world for what we call good or evil. Because the essence of man is his consciousness, The true nature of man is perforce magical. All men have infinite potential to create whatever changes they may desire. But at present, man on earth seems lacking in the knowledge of his true nature and the abilities of his mind. Most men fluctuate as a matter of daily habit between slightly good and slightly evil, building up a slight potential in one direction and discharging it, then swinging back a bit the other way. This puts him down in a potential well of thought. Since he is not polarizing steadily in either direction, he can do no magic. Those sufficiently polarized, like Jesus the Christ, perform this magic with no difficulty. Everyone does have the innate ability to do such magic. The beginning of the Gospel according to John in the Holy Bible contains this statement: "The true light that enlightens every man was coming into the world. To all who received him, who believed in his name, he gave power to become children of God, who were born not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God." 7 I am not in any way suggesting that the unity with God, or Creator, or the Christ, is only valid when approached through the doctrines of any particular religion, but the concept is clearly stated here. When Jesus told his disciples, "These things and more shall you do," he intended that those who heard those words polarize their consciousness until they regain the natural abilities which we presently call miraculous. Many of the UFO sources indicate that they feel that man on earth has trouble recognizing in many instances the difference between positive and negative thought, and for that reason is vacillating between the two. There are lots of people who have heard about or read a little of the UFO contactee literature, who dismiss it as being a series of ridiculous fantasies, like the French peasants reporting stones falling from the sky. 49, Chapter 3, Reality, etc. If a handful of people reported contact instead of thousands, and if the communications they reported varied widely in content instead of matching, then there would be a much poorer case for UFO contact. I have worked with teenagers who had no previous background at all in UFO research or literature who, after a very short training period, were able to receive, in a telepathic manner, hours of communications of the exact type reported by UFO contactees. Comparison of this information with information obtained by other widely separated contactee sources over the past 20 years always results in the same conclusion, that the basic message content, no matter where or who the receiver was, is the same. Earlier I spoke of the UFO contactee picture as a kind of puzzle, and a fairly big one at that. Some of the pieces of this puzzle seem silly or even crazy when one first picks them up, but carefully pieced together, these contactee stories begin to form a recognizable pattern of UFO motive. I think this pattern is not easily recognized or understood for the same reason that gelarized spoons are hard to accept. There is very little previous experience on which to base an analysis. But that the pattern exists is hard to deny. As ufologist Brad Stager puts it, "For the past 3 years I have been conducting a serious study of certain contactees, whom I call flying saucer missionaries, and I have noted that a certain percentage of the information dispensed in their cosmic sermonettes has contained a good deal of accurate information and that certain predictions have been realized." In my opinion, many UFO researchers, and nearly all news media and orthodox scientists, have been too hasty in their assessments that the contactees' messages are just so much nonsense and science fiction-inspired pseudo-religious prattle. Although several of the contactees seem to parrot in a tedious manner a great amount of the same basic message, there may be important clues hidden for us in their fanciful distortions if only we were to work a bit harder to separate the cosmic wheat from the celestial chaff. 8 And longtime researcher, Professor J. H. Bruning of the University of Mississippi, has this to say about UFO phenomena: "After studying it closely for 30 years, UFO phenomena is a contrived paranormal event created for the benefit of the viewer with a specific stimulus. Content is a show-and-tell device precisely geared to the culture to which it is presented." 50, Chapter 3, Reality, etc. Note that all historical UFO sightings are always just slightly advanced for the viewers of the time. Medieval sightings were of a fully rigged sailing ship sailing along in the sky. The 1897 sightings looked like a Victorian science fiction book illustration, and the crews were all reported as being dressed properly for 1890. Current sightings are spaceships with astronauts as pilots dressed in space suits. Obviously, neither a sailing ship fully rigged nor a Jules Verne ship could possibly travel through interplanetary space in those forms from another planet to the Earth and back. They all were here in physical form to be sure and were reported as such, but they did not get here in that form by flying here. Display is intentional and is a part of a controlled program of cultural diffusion of special forms of information into current Earth civilizations.